Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Joel Kanaski, 46 years of combination experience, retired firefighter from the FDNY who rode Rescue 1 for 16 out of his 20-year career. From a young age, Joel knew he was destined to become a firefighter following three out of his four brothers who were volunteers. Joel started out with Alexandria Fire Department, moving up to the rank of lieutenant before deciding to switch departments after 9 years. The move wasn't easy, but well worth it after listening to Joel's experiences and the individuals who he had the pleasure of working alongside with. My favorite quote from Joel is, "Company officers has to be proficient in everything he expects his members to do." With that, I present Joel Kanaski.
Hi, my name is Joel Kanaski, and how I got in the fire service was when I was a young boy, my father passed away when I was about a year old, so I always had that look for father figures. And my older brothers became volunteer firemen in my little town, and I started hanging out there, and I started seeing a lot of great people doing great things. It was just amazing, you know, guys that didn't get paid anything showed up and battled the beast all the time. You know, when I was a young kid growing up, there was a lot of fires in my little town, I seen, and I got to see a lot of heroic things, and that sort of made me know where I wanted to go.
Okay, so you mentioned you had older brothers before you.
Yeah,
and go ahead.
I had four older brothers.
And all of them were volunteers?
Let's see. One, two, three.
Three volunteers. Okay. And did any of them move over to the career side, or did they stay a volunteer?
One of them actually moved over to the career side as an industrial firefighter.
Okay. All right. And so, needless to say, you saw your older brothers doing it. It was natural. You were going to go, hey, this is what I'm going to do.
It was, I became a volunteer there. And then, being a young crazy kid, you know, things, school wasn't for me. And then the United States Marine Corps seemed like a good choice to get me out of trouble.
Okay.
I actually became a fireman in the Marine Corps.
Okay.
I was a fireman in the Marine Corps for a little over four years, the first time, and about a year the second time.
Okay. And then whenever you finished your tours, why the FDNY, or was that even your first choice?
All right. Well, no, actually, I got out of the Marine Corps in Virginia, and I became a firefighter and then a lieutenant in Alexandria, Virginia first. So I did a little over eight years, almost 9 years there. And I was waiting to get back onto the FDNY to go home, I thought. And it was always my dream to be on the FDNY. And things worked out in Alexandria. It was a great place. It was just an old school fire department, sort of like where you are now.
Okay.
Just a fire department who just, a lot of great guys. All my officers were 40-year guys there, all senior great officers, showing you the way all the time. But that was where I started out, and then I finally got back to the FDNY after about 9 years.
Okay. If I can ask, you know, you said you left there as a lieutenant, so you were starting to climb to the ranks. Was it a difficult decision after 9 years to depart and switch departments?
Yeah, it was kind of tough. I mean, the pay cut was pretty big. It was a big thing. My wife was born and raised in Virginia, and I met her there. And, it was a big move for her, too. And it was always a dream, though. And like I said, I wanted to make that attempt. And being a lieutenant was good. I I sound stupid, but I missed the back step when I became the boss there. Because bosses there didn't sit in the kitchen and hang out with the guys. You know, you're a boss, sort of like in New York. You know, you're a boss, you have a meal with the boys, you talk with the drill. But, you know, you're not one of the guys in the kitchen. I sort of missed that in a lot of ways, because in the Marine Corps it was different, you know. Even the section chief or the whoever it was would always, it was just one group there. So I sort of missed that, too. It was just different. But, yeah, no, it was a hard decision, believe me. There was a lot of pros and cons. But it worked out for the best, I think.
Okay. So you pack up everything, move to New York, join the FDNY. I'm assuming you had to do another recruit class, correct?
Yeah, I did so many recruit schools, I could write some books. Actually, Yeah, I went to recruit school there, and recruit school there was only 8 weeks, 7.5 weeks. It was all, nuts and bolts, push hose, climb ladders, jump off ropes. It was just basic, basic, basic all the time. I was lucky enough to graduate the valedictorian in my class of about 200. I think they cheated me and gave it to me. I don't think I won it, but, I'm not sure. I know there was a kid on the who I was good friends with, he was tied with me for number one for a long time. And I know I, for a fact, I threw two questions on the final exam. So, but whether he missed three or they lied and said I didn't miss them, I had no idea at this point, this many years later. But it was an amazing time. It really was. It was hoses, ladders, ropes, no nonsense. One day a week, he went to a sleep officer training because in New York, you have to be a sworn peace officer. So you can write violations and tickets and stuff like that. So that was 1 week of police stuff you had to do, and that was pretty slack. But other than that, all good.
Okay. So with being top of your class, I'm assuming when you get that, are you allowed to put in for a specific assignment?
Yeah, you sort of get brought into the office of the training captain, and he asks you. He says, "Where do you want to go?" And being a fireman and a guy, I knew enough not to go, I want to go to 44 truck, or I want to go here. And I just told him, I said, I'd like to go to a tower ladder in the Bronx. And about a day or two later, he called me back in the office, and there was another captain standing there who was an Irish guy who I couldn't understand his brogue. And he goes, "This is the captain, 17 truck, and he'd like you to go to his house. What do you think?" And I said, "Well, that's perfect for me." So I got to go to a great firehouse, 1617, the Green Berets of the South Bronx. It was a completely different world from Alexandria, Virginia. I can say that much.
I bet. So tell us, what was it like walking through the doors on your first shift there?
Well, I'll tell you what, I felt like it was that first day of boot camp, jumping on the yellow footprints again. It was just a completely different world. True fireman. No nonsense. Back to basics. The firehouse was a shithole, the apparatus was beat up, they were great guys, and it was just an amazing time. It was definitely scary. Guys don't want to admit that, but it was definitely scary just feeling your way.
And so I'm assuming with you having some prior experience, did you kind of go in and act like I'm new here, or did the guys kind of know that and you just kind of wanted to keep that secret?
Well, I didn't give anything up, but as you know, in the fire service, they find out anything they want to find out.
Right.
I kept quiet. I asked questions. There was things there I learned that I'd been a fireman already at that point, because at 16, I became a wildland DEC guy in New York, young kid, working as a forest warden. And then, with the volunteer service and then the Marine Corps and then Alexandria. So I had a lot of time, and there was things I was still learning every day in the firehouse. It was amazing. Just, it was truly, I hate to say, back to basics for my buddy Andy Fredericks, but back to basics for sure. A lot of just true dirt knowledge, using a Halligan the right way, really just doing things. It was amazing. They said, and of course they found out what they wanted to find out, but I never gave up a lot of information. I kept holding back as much as I could, but they knew. Somebody ratted me out. I don't know who did. Somebody ratted me out.
Okay. With that being said, did you find yourself, or was it even an option? Did you find yourself wanting to emulate, like pretty much finding the go-getters, the guys that were into the job, or was that a non-negotiable getting assigned to that specific station?
That was when you're in the FDNY, when you're assigned to a house, you could spend your whole career there and never have to move. Two times where you move is when you request to move or when you get in trouble. Those are the only two times you'll get moved. And like you said, if you get in trouble, it depends how bad it is. Sometimes you get moved for 90 days, 30 days, or sometimes you get moved to a different house permanently. But like I said, you could stay your whole career there. And we had guys that had been there 20 some 30 years, and hardcore firemen. They knew the ins and outs of the job. It was just all the senior guys, all the senior chauffeurs in the truck that I was in were spectacular. Same thing with the engine. The engine had some great senior men, and they made sure, not only did you learn how to polish the brass, the poles and the nozzle, and keep the tools clean, but you learned how to use everything too. So it was a great experience that way. I wish I had had that experience before I became a boss in Virginia. It would have taught me a lot on how to lead the right way, or as a senior man even, it would have taught me a lot how to lead.
Okay. With what you just said, where did you feel like you lacked when it came to being a boss in Alexandria?
It was I lacked in the fact that I really didn't understand that, 10 or 15% of the job, no matter what, are not into the job. As a young lieutenant there, I didn't understand that. And like you said, I attempted to always look at the 10 to 15% weren't good for me. It was making me, feel like I should do something better for them. But I come to realize, there's two things that you hear in the fire service all the time now. One is, times are changing and these guys are no good. And Bob Morris, one of the greatest fire officers I ever met and worked for, said that when he came on the job in 1970 something, they were telling him how the job had changed and that it was, going to be terrible next year. And it's so untrue. Nothing changes. The only thing that changes is sometimes the young guys are younger and they're maybe not as smart and may not know how to use a screwdriver, but nothing changes. There's still that 10 or 15% that are just there, and there's still that 75 or 80% that love the job and have a true calling. But in Alexandria, I wish I had known. I wouldn't have spent as much time worrying about that 10 or 15% that I wasn't going to ever change anyway, because I had no heart in it, and I could have really concentrated on that 75 or 80% that just wanted to do the job. And it'd been a lot better off that way. But that was, and I learned that in New York, because like you said, that every guy in the firehouse, there's like simple basic rules in New York City, like a line of duty funeral. You do not miss a line of duty funeral unless you're working or dead. And the guys will make sure if you miss it and say, oh, I had to go shopping or I had to do this, they will ride you and take care of you. And same thing with Memorial Day, the same thing, when house events, you step up and do the right thing. And that's what I think keeps the fire service going. That's why it hasn't really changed, because there's always going to be that senior guy.
Right. Okay. So at what point in your career did you decide to make the switch from riding the truck over to then moving over to the rescue?
Well, I could tell you, as a young boy, I watched a video clip of Paul Hashhagen when he did the helicopter rescue of Jane Doornacher in the Hudson River. And I was probably about, I don't know. I'm sorry, Paul. I know I'm making you sound old, but I was probably like a young teenager. I might have been just in the Marine Corps. And I realized then I always wanted to go to a rescue company in New York. I just, in Virginia, I was a trainer for and a member of the state team for technical rescue for the whole state. And we did a ton of training, a ton of training, a ton of training, but we never really got to, do a lot of technical rescue. I did a couple of trench rescues, a couple of rope rescues, but nothing crazy. And looking at the rescue companies in New York, in Rescue One, it's not a daily occurrence, but it's pretty damn close. You're going to be on a train, in a tank, on a rope, in a collapse. You're going to be doing something or a fire every day or close to every day. And I knew I wanted to go there. I just didn't know how long it would take or if I would ever get the chance. And I got lucky enough that about my third or fourth year in the company, my captain at the time, Jimmy Hodgins, they called him the dentist because he drilled all the time. I mean, he drilled three or four times a day with us. But he had asked me about what type of training we did in Virginia. And I showed him a program that I had set up in Virginia with the help of a young college student on PowerPoint, because PowerPoint was brand new then. And what we did is I would go out on my days off and I would shoot a couple of photos and I would drop them into the PowerPoint. So then when we were sitting in the fire station, I could show the photos of buildings in our area that we wanted to talk about. And he was like, that's freaking amazing. We could do that for the nighttime drill at the firehouse. The guys wouldn't be upset because we could be at the kitchen table. We 15, 20 minutes, half hour. And you talk about real buildings. I get a picture of the front, the top, the back, and you drop it in. So about I guess I had about 4 years, maybe a little less on the job. And the fire commissioner, Tom Van Essen, came to dinner at the firehouse because he was a good man that he always visited the companies. And he came to the firehouse and the captain showed him this program that we were doing. And he goes, I want that for the whole fire department. He said, so he told the captain, he said, I'll detail you down to headquarters and you could teach some guys how to do it and they'll go out and do it. And the captain goes, well, I didn't do it. And he pointed to me. And that started the path. I worked with Dennis Murphy and, geez, two other gents that were killed in the 11th. Yeah, I'll think of their names in a minute here. I hate that. God. Captain of Rescue 4 and Captain Alotta 24. But we, I went down with them and we set up the program and they went through the job and they'd go out and do firehouses every day and it worked best. And about, I was there for about 3 months helping out. And at the end of the 3 months, they said, okay, the commissioner wants to see you. So I went to his office. He said, what would you like? I said, I'd like the opportunity to go to a rescue company one day. He goes, okay, well, he says, I can't make you go to a rescue company. That's a captain's choice. He said, but I can call him and ask him to give you an interview, but that it's up to you if you perform or not perform, because that's the way it works here, is that rescue captains pick their crew handpick. So I said, okay. And he set up an interview for me in Rescue One. He said, you don't want to go to Rescue Three in the Bronx? And I said, well, I said, I like technical rescue. And I says, it's the big city, you know, it's, I like to try that. So he set up an interview with Captain John Norman. And I went for my interview. I don't know if I did good or bad. I don't know where I performed. You know, they really don't give up a lot. You know, he wrote some notes on a piece of paper. I don't know, you know, and said, okay, well, I'll let you know. And about a month later, he got moved into the captain's development program, or the chief's development program, excuse me, where he was going to get promoted. So they made him ride in the back seat of the chief's car for a month or two to figure out how to become a chief. So Terry Hatton had taken his place temporarily, and Terry Hatton had called me up and said, I want you to come down for a second interview. I said, okay, that was unheard of. And I went down for the second interview. He looked at the paper. He said, okay, everything's confirmed here. He said, okay. He said, you'll hear something in a couple of days. He didn't, you know, he didn't say I was coming to the company or anything. He just said, you'll hear something in a couple of days. So I go back. I'm in 17 truck, like maybe a week later. And the captain comes down and says to me, he says, Monday, you start in Rescue One. This is like on Saturday night. So, that's how it all started. It was a pretty amazing journey.
If I can ask, and I'm sure some of the listeners would love to know as well, if you can divulge, what were some of the questions that they would ask you to come on Rescue One?
Well, they first thing they do is they write, they ask you any educational, technical, or trade school idea that you've had. You know, so I put my military time, I put my fire department time. I was a paramedic at one point, so I put that down. I was still currently an EMT, so I put all that down. I was a scuba diver. So you put all that down, and they ask questions about your, those technicalities and you know, what types of things you did outside the fire department also. They want to know, like, are you an electrician? Are you a welder? Could you do any of these specialty skills? Because, like, Bobby Galeone from Rescue 2 once said, you know, as long as you have hardened balls, excuse me, we could teach you everything else. You know, and if you have a basic understanding of how things work, they could teach you all the technical stuff in the world. You know, it's hard to teach a person how to go to fires. It really is. You know, they could follow you and emulate you, but that's all you, how you teach. You can't really like tell them, okay, you're going to feel this or that, you know, at a fire. But technical jobs, they can teach you. So they ask you those types of questions though, about any technical abilities you have. I think, you know, between my medic, my military record, and my fire department training that I had, I mean, I had thousands and thousands of hours of fire department training because I was in Virginia. And that was like what you do in Virginia. I mean, you get certified in everything, basket weaving to screwdriver usage, you can get a certificate for in Virginia. And it was just, I think that's what helped me out. I'm not sure.
Okay. So nonchalantly, your captain comes downstairs, lets you know, hey, you'll be reporting there. What was that experience like? Because I've seen the pictures, I've seen the video of the quarters of Rescue One, but was it surreal walking through those doors knowing you are a part of this company?
Well, you get what they tell you is you're there for 90 days.
Oh, okay.
The end of 90 days, you the captain will make the decision about you. Now, after being in there for so many years, I realize it's not the captain making the decision 90% of the time; it's the member. A lot of guys, if they come, they realize after about 30 or 40 days that this is probably not for them, whatever reason. those are the guys that leave. I've never, I think I've had one guy that in those years that the captain asked to leave. And he just didn't have a lot of capabilities physically, I don't think. But I was walking through that door was amazing again, because now I think every guy in the company when I got there had 20 plus years, and I had four and a half. You know, and I was the first new guy to the company in 6 or 7 months, maybe a year. But there was a ton of senior guys, like the chauffeurs all had 30 years almost. You know, so you just walk in and they said Paul Hashagen was there, a guy I analyzed since a teenager. You know, Davey Williams, all these senior chauffeurs, crazy, just senior men that you knew. And then the first time I saw them in Class A's, I realized the difference in me and them. Their jacket weighed a lot more with all the medals on their chest than my little, I looked like a probie with a badge.
Oh man. Was it unheard of to have only 4 years on to get on the rescue?
Well, at that time, it was in the changing at that point because the squad companies had been just formed, so they were trying to change it to make that you had your first grade before you went. It didn't happen till after I went, but I thought maybe I had been the youngest member brought to a rescue company, and then Captain Hatton told me no, he beat me by 3 months.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't unheard of, but it wasn't common. I don't know. I just think I hit it at the right time, and I had a few of the good recommendations, whether it was guys from the South Bronx who recommended me. It was just the luck of the draw, I think. I don't know. Maybe the big man upstairs was looking out for me, got me there.
And with FDNY has five rescues, one for each borough. Can you tell us like a shift where you had an absurd amount of runs? Was it what you expected, or a shift where you responded to numerous fires?
I can tell you, hitting the triple decker, a third alarm, a second alarm, and an all hands in the night or in a 24. Going to fires was amazing. Like you said, I didn't like fires in the winter. The summer fires I didn't mind because as long as you drank fluids, you were okay. The winter fires, you can never seem to do anything to get yourself comfortable after a
Right,
fire.
right.
And we had two sets of gear, but again, in a rescue company, if you went to two fires, you were wearing wet stuff no matter what by the second job. I think the most amazing thing about the runs at one were I could go from a scuba run during the day, pull somebody out of the river, somebody underneath a train in the evening, to a building fire that night. And it wasn't that way every night, but a lot of nights you had something going on, always going on. I counted on my thing. I think I had 7 nights on a night tour, the 15-hour night tour that I didn't have a run. 7 nights. It was crazy that way. You always had something going on. Like you said, a lot of
Right.
times it was nonsense. You got turned around because the regular companies could handle
Okay.
it. The rescue always didn't go to work. We did work about, in the good years, we worked about 75, 78% of the time. So you did something at the jobs. But again, we didn't go on local medical runs. We didn't go on fire alarms. We didn't go on a local boxes unless they were in a few blocks of the neighborhood, or it was in a few blocks of the firehouse. It was reported to be a structural fire, and then we would go on the box. But other than that, you were only going on, if the dispatcher thought it was something, they'd send you. If it was a trauma run, we did do, unlike the other rescue companies initially, we did construction site trauma runs. So if there was an accident at a construction site, we were assigned initially, which did help us out. On the other hand, we did that thing called 53Xs, which were report extrications. But what happened there was the 911 callers, instead of the fire department dispatchers, were taking the info. So they would ask, is the person still in the car? And they'd say yes, so they would put it out as an extrication run. So even if the person was sitting in the car, they would put it out as an extrication run. So we did a lot of those. It turned out to be nothing. And I think it was because they were the 911 call takers were doing the information rather than the fire department call takers.
Okay.
But yeah, so I mean, there was a lot of crazy nights. I went home tired a lot of times.
I bet.
As I got home later in my time, because I didn't really have a true second job like a lot of guys. I didn't bang nails or do plumbing or anything like that. I was lucky. My wife had a job as a nurse, so I could goof off. I did have a little side gig where I worked for the Office of Emergency Management where I live, doing their hazard materials stuff for them. But that was like on call and four calls and a little bit here or there, not much. So a lot of times in between, I worked straight tours. Joey Angelini, Al Benjamin, Captain Haddon, they all worked straight tours all the time. So they did the 9 hour days and the 15 hour nights. So I ended up doing straight tours for a long time while I was there. So in between my night tours, a lot of times I would just hang out at the firehouse, sleep a little late, walk around Manhattan, look at buildings, stuff like that. And in between the day tours, a lot of times I would go up to the corner and have dinner and just stay in the firehouse for the night because that way I didn't have to drive and get up, early to get into the city. So I was lucky in that way that I didn't have to have that second job. So I was it gave me a little more leniency. And then when I later, oh, go ahead.
Is that something you bid for, or because I know you most of the time you either do you like you flip flop between a day tour and a night tour.
No, the schedule in New York City is 2 9-hour days, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. You're off a day and a half. Then you come in on a day, that half day, you come in at 6 p.m. and you work till 9 a.m., two night tours. And then depending on the calendar, you're off 3, 4, or 5 days. So a lot of guys do straight tours, but if you do 24s, what would happen is you would work 24 and you're off 3, 4, or 5. Work 24 off 3, 4, or 5. So what would happen is you'd have a partner opposite you, and he'd be on his nights when you're on your days. So you would work one day in his night, and then he would come in and work your second day in his second night. And then you would keep going like that. You'd have a strict 24-hour partner. A
Okay.
lot most of the guys in the firehouse did that. They did 24s. A lot of them did night to night, though, not day to day. So they came in at, 4 or 5 in the afternoon and then went home the next night at 6 or 7.
Okay. Man, interesting. And I mean, just hit listening to you talk, you've mentioned individuals, Bob Morris, Al Benjamin, I'm pretty sure you're talking about the I call him the Godfather of building construction. You mentioned that he's then switched over to the Chiefs car to ride the back.
John Norman.
John Norman.
Keith Norman.
So
Yeah, I
what?
hate him because I had to study his book when I was studying for lieutenant.
Oh,
The first time my wife met him at a company function, she goes, "You're the one that wrote the book." Because she used to have to ask me questions out of the book all the time. So, yeah.
I mean, just the people that you were around and who they became, who they are. I mean, that's gotta set that precedence to, to speak to who you are today.
Oh, no ifs, ands, or buts. I say it all the time that, there's not a great fireman in this world. It's who you are surrounded by makes the difference. No ifs, ands, or buts. There's not a great company captain or chief. It's the guys that work for you or around you that sort of mold you because, I think the senior man is the most amazing thing in the fire service because the senior man, unlike the company officer, the guys around you can emulate you. They can be you. They can't be the company officer. They don't have that responsibility. They don't have to make decisions. They make decisions in their head. And a lot of company officers, especially in the rescue company, go, "Oh, hey, what do you think we should do?" Because, you see things as a rescue company you would never see as an engine or a truck or have to do. But I think that senior man thing, because they can emulate you. If you're a good guy and you're out drilling with them and showing, they just want to do what you do because they want to be you. I got lucky. Like I said, David Williams, Hash Hagen, Benjamin. Gary Geidel, Patty O'Keefe, Jerry Nevins, all these guys were just rock stars. And I remember when you first learned to tie a knot in like your first recruit school? You're like, "Oh, wow, this is hard as hell." And these guys were doing it in their sleep, behind their back. We were using cutting torches, laying upside down in a piece of pipe because they wanted to do it the way you were going to be doing it at a job. And it was just amazing to learn from them and watch them. And, they would. The most amazing part about it was if you did something stupid, they would call you on it, but it was gone after that. They'd call you on it and then it'd be over.
Okay. What were the different positions when you're assigned to a rescue squad? Of course, you have your chauffeur and your officer.
Chauffeur and
And okay, and then what else?
then we have three different types of positions in the rescue. So you have a firefighting position. So the firefighting positions are the can, the irons, the hook, and the roof. So the can, is his job is to go to the first line and make sure the first line is moving or that the fire conditions aren't changing drastically. The hook and the irons are to go to the floor above no matter what. That's why the can goes to the line. It's not because the engines aren't doing their job. It's because our above team goes to the floor above no matter what. And he's watching to make sure that fire conditions aren't coming out the door, getting in the hallway. We're going to trap them above. So you have that team going to, and the roof man always goes to the roof. And a good example of that is in two truck companies, you could have two junior guys with less than 6 months on the job, 8 months on the job, have the roof. So you'd have one senior guy on the roof being the rescue guy or the squad guy. That's the firefighting positions. The chauffeur is sort of like a free safety. He usually goes with the can man to make sure it's a team of two. But he could also do something if the boss needs something specialty done, he could do that. Next one you have is your technical rescue position. My bird's going berserk. So in the technical rescue position, what happens is the can man is the CFR guy. So his job is to make sure the patient is cared for, bleeding is stopped, basic EMS stuff. You know, whether he's hanging on the side of a building in a collapse, that's what his job is. So he carries aid equipment, you know, BVM, oxygen, suction, stuff like that, basic. The next one is the tool man. So that's the irons guy. He's the tool man. And what his job is, anything that's got to be operated, first tool, cutters, torches, he operates it. Then you have the hook. The hook is the rigger. So he's the setup man. So if it's a rope system or a rigging system, that's who has to lay out the system. If it's a tool that's got to be set up, he sets it up for the tool man.
Okay.
No, it's a, you got to hook up hydraulics. That's his job. The roof man is logistics. So he's with the chauffeur at the rig because in a rescue company, there's always an A, B, and a C way for a technical rescue. So the A way is something we could jump off the rig with, a battery tool, a crowbar. You could jump off the rig with it and go. The B tool is something that takes a few more minutes to get set up, the Hurst tool, a jack. That's the B tool. If the A tool didn't work, we go to the B tool. And then the C tool is our last, which is our jackhammers, heavy torches, exothermic torches, you know, stuff, rigging, cable, vice grips, stuff like that, that would be the C tool. So that's how the teamwork that a technical does. And then the last job we have is a dive job. Every night in a rescue company, there's two rescue divers assigned. You have the primary diver and the backup diver. Yes, Bertie, walk-a-doo. The primary diver, his responsibility is to be able, when we arrive on the box, jump in the water and go underwater. The backup diver initially is assigned as the surface guy. So if we get to the box and it's just somebody clinging to a piling or on top of a car, he's dressed with a PFD so he can take a rope, jump in, and go to the person.
Okay.
Surface rescue. If not, when the diver goes down, the other two guys dress that backup diver and they tend each of the divers. And then the rescue chauffeur, again, is the guy who brings the ladder or any other equipment that may be needed. So those are the three positions that we have in a rescue company. You have a firefighting, a technical rescue, and a dive position.
Okay. Okay. And so with that being said, you stayed out of your career of 20 years, 16 of those were spent on Rescue One. So my question to you is, did you ever want to promote, or was it, I'm having too much fun, I don't want to do it, or I've done it before at another organization, I just want to stay a fireman here?
It was a combination of that. I mean, from what I learned in Alexandria, but I truly had gotten to a place where I had never imagined it was amazing. Like you said, there was not a, except for one or two handful of days, maybe I could say 6 days or 7 days that I came home from work not feeling blessed that I was in a rescue company. 6 or 7 days total in my career. And those were all usually line of duty firefighter deaths, including the 11th. But other than that, there wasn't a day I didn't come home. You know, as my wife puts it, you know, in New York City, your vacation is 7 weeks and you get assigned it. You don't get to pick it. You know, it's given by a chart. You know, 5 years ahead of time when it's going to be. The only thing you could do is you could swap half of it with somebody else or swap a hole with somebody else. So, my wife used to say, I used to take a whole vacation because I thought it was less punishment because I was only out of the firehouse once and then I was back. But she would go by about 3.5 weeks. She'd go, can't they take you back early? It was, it was just amazing. You missed it. You know, I missed the kitchen. I missed going to work. It was, every day was kind of exciting like that.
So when you took vacation, you had to take a full 7 weeks.
Well, 7 weeks or a half,
or
which
half.
was 3 or 4. Yeah, you had to
Okay.
take it either way. And it was, and you knew ahead of time, each captain had their own method too. Like some of the captains gave the union delegate always got a pick of a vacation automatically. He could pick any vacation he wanted. And then some of the captains would give that same thing to the senior man. They let him pick whatever he wanted, or his chauffeur. Sometimes they would, the four chauffeurs at the company, they would allow to pick what you wanted. You know, it was mixed up in the fire. Some guys wanted that November, December for hunting. You know, some guys wanted Christmas because it was they were big family guys. Some guys wanted a beach vacation, summertime. You know, there was skier guys in the firehouse. They wanted the January vacation. So, you know, if you were stuck with that 7 weeks, January to February, you're like, oh, darn, what am I going to do? And some guy would go, I'm going to Colorado. Can I have it?
Oh, okay.
So it was always, and if you needed something, it was never a problem.
Okay. Let's see here. So for instance, your chauffeur, he takes off. Do you move up to drive?
All right, so the way that worked is if the chauffeur was off, the next senior guy would step up to be the chauffeur.
Okay.
Most of the time it depended. Like if the company was really short of guys, another chauffeur would put in to take the overtime spot or put in to work a scheduled overtime. So we'd have a regular rescue chauffeur. The same way the regular rescue chauffeurs didn't work in the back of the rig very often. We didn't try to take those spots from the guys because I know it was the way it was. And every now and then you had to work overtime in the back of the rig. But a lot of times in one, what we would do is you'd look at the book and say, okay, there's no chauffeur this day. I'll put in for an overtime tour or a scheduled overtime tour because we got 96 hours a year of scheduled overtime. So you would, or 96 hours of a quarter, I'm sorry.
Okay.
You get scheduled overtime you could put in for. But if not, it would be the senior guy in the back of the rig. Almost everybody in the rescue company was a chauffeur, went to chauffeur school. Because
okay.
Most guys were in a truck or an engine, and they were there for a while, so they were chauffeurs already.
Okay. All right. With that being said, I'm going to ask you a couple official questions because I just always like to deep dive, especially when it comes to FDNY, how you guys do things, the history, and all that good stuff.
Uh-oh.
What does the term aggressive mean to you?
The term aggressive means that I'm confident to do my job. I know what to do in my job and I know my parameters. It doesn't mean freelancing. It doesn't mean anything else. It means that, you know, in a rescue company, sometimes you operate by yourself. I know there's people cringing all over the world right now. You know, you should be able to force a door by yourself. If you cannot force a door by yourself, there's something wrong. It could be that the engine company got stuck on the other side of the door because the hose went under the door and they can't get out. You should be able to operate. On the same token, you should have enough respect for your company officer and your chief officers that you're not going to do something that's going to make them cringe, you know, and have to discipline you. You know, there are moves, like I said, there are moves you have to make sometimes that they're going to either have to give you a medal or they're going to have to give you a rip.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That just, you have to be able to stand up for that, but you got to know your job is the biggest thing. You have to know every inch of the job and be prepared. If there was an A, B, and C book written out there on how to do a fire department job, it'd be a bestseller because there is none. There is none. You know, there's a lot of knowledge out there, but there's nothing that tells you for everything, single thing you go to, how to do it or what to do. You know, every fire is different. If your heart doesn't pitter patter, still going to a job,
mm-hmm.
what you? I mean, it's time to retire because there's something wrong upstairs. Because, like I said, every job is different, and then there's always that few minutes at every job before you know the white smoke comes out or you hear the water hitting on the walls. That it's a little crazy, but aggressive to me is knowing your job. That's the biggest thing, being capable of doing things.
Okay. With that being said, with you being on Rescue One, was there ever a shift where you guys didn't train? Because I'm sure you guys dabbled the jack of all trades being on a rescue from water, rope, high angle, low. I mean, the plethora, it's crazy. So I'm assuming every time you went to work, a drill was conducted.
I mean, every day there was three drills usually. So what would happen is every day had a certain type of tool or equipment that had to be checked. So like today might be scuba day, tomorrow maybe hydraulics, next day maybe collapse tools, saws. Saws were started every regular firefighting saws were started twice a day, but there was always three drills. There was two practical drills, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and then in the evening when the guys came in for the night tour. Why? After dinner was being prepped, there was always some sort of in-house drill, a tabletop, something of that nature. Terry Hatton and some of the bosses I worked for did a fourth drill. They would do the morning drill before the start of the tour, while the guys were having coffee, donuts and bacon and eggs at the table. They would throw something on the table, a picture, something to talk about, throw that type of drill. There was always a drill going on in the firehouse, at least three or four times a day.
Okay.
That's why some guys left. I truly think so.
Because they're tired.
I mean, wasn't a lot of downtime. If you were used to being in
Right.
a firehouse, it was slower, didn't have, had a lot of downtime.
Right.
But it was hard to convert.
Right. No, I can see that. I can see that. With that being said, so it's no, pretty much it happens everywhere, meaning you not all of FDNY have individuals that are go-getters. You do have your guys that just wanna, they're here, but they just wanna lay back.
That 10 or 15% everywhere I said, we just need to accept that. There's nothing you can do. Like you said, we didn't make the rules. If you're a go-getter, you didn't make the rules. The fire department turns the other cheek on them sometimes. When it's the same guy, you can't, throw a ladder at a job and everybody notices it, but nobody says anything. Or it's the engine company that abandons the line, but nobody says anything. It's not my job to say it. It's my job to put the fire out. So if you leave the line, I'm going to take the nozzle and put the fire out. That's what has to happen. It just at 10 or 15%, no matter what. And I don't think you'll ever change that. And they said, those guys, somebody used to complain about guys at the rock or guys doing special details. And I used to say, look, if you don't shut up, they're going to make you do that. And it happened. Right when I got to the rescue companies, they were having trouble getting recruit or probie school instructors. So they went to the command, and out of every special operations unit, they took one guy for a recruit school. For probie school. And in Rescue One, what they did is the guy, the captain said, okay, anybody on the lieutenant's list, this is good for you to go learn. It was easy for me. I didn't have to go. But, and that happened. And then guys started stepping up a little bit more. But, there's guys that fit in everywhere. The guy that wants to drive the delivery truck and deliver the supplies, so be it. God bless him. He doesn't want to go to fires. He doesn't do that. Somebody's got to do that job. It's better than having that 10 or 15% around you, but they're always going to be there. I don't think there's anything we can do about it. And I said, I wish I had known younger in my career just to concentrate more with the guys who really wanted to be there.
Right.
And that might
Okay.
have helped 10 or 15% step up. I don't know.
Okay. What's your take on outside training?
Well, I think it's a great thing. Outside training is it's a good little tool for the toolbox. Because sometimes you get to see something different. What I found, though, and I still run two or three seminars a year for a foundation, I find sometimes that guys who read a book or thought about doing it and then try and teach it to you, it's pretty obvious right off the bat. You think of some of the stuff these guys come up with, whether it's a way to crawl or a way to do whatever, or a way to remove a victim. I don't think they ever removed a victim. I hate to say that, because I think back, I said, every person I've ever grabbed in a fire has been a slimy, wild ball mess with no clothes on or clothes didn't last long. All the techniques you're talking about, or, oh, take your webbing out and put it around them. Well, when the flames are beating you down the hallway, you're hoping that you're not going to die while you're dragging this person out. So, I mean, it is a great tool in the toolbox. And I think it's really cool if you can come back and show the guys. You know, in the FDNY, we did some technical out training like scuba. We sent some guys to outside in commercial diver schools to see different things like that. And it's always good to come back. And like I said, you just have to be able to, when you bring stuff back, you have to be able to fit it to your department. You know, if you have three guys, you cannot do what the FDNY does
Right.
for doing a ladder company. It ain't going to happen. You know, if you have two guys on a rig, 99% of the fire departments in America, you can't do what they do. So you have to be able to take what you've learned outside and fit it to your department rather than beat a drum. You know, it's a two in, two out thing. If I only have four guys on the first alarm, the two in, two out thing isn't going to go too well. You know, unless I'm talking about the chief who's in his coat and the guy who delivers toilet paper showing up to take pictures. You know, you got to fit it to your department. That's how outside training fits in. I think it's a spectacular thing. I mean, there's guys that I see at these three seminars we do, some of the most knowledgeable guys in the world. You could tell they're still true firemen. They know. They're rocking guys.
In your opinion, with the amount of years that you have under your belt, do you see certain things that have come back that it's sort of like we're just reinventing the wheel?
Yeah, sometimes I think, you know, the newest tool in innovation, sometimes new tools and innovations are good. And then other times I think what happens is we get them in and then we realize that maybe the old way was better because it worked. You know, and I'm not, you know, it's like the 6 foot Halligan hook. You know, it had the Halligan on the top and it had the pry bar on the bottom, but it was 6 foot, about 28 pounds. It was a great idea in the long run, but having to run five flights of stairs with it and operate it wasn't a good idea. So, I mean, it was one of those things that sometimes tools and innovation come around. I think what's more important is that you're able to say, "Nah, this doesn't work after we tried it." But I think you should try it. I think new things should always be tried and looked at. You know, we're pretty lucky in Rescue One because if somebody developed a new tool or a new technique, it was magical how they wanted to deliver it for free.
Gotcha.
We got in a lot of trouble for that. I mean, I had a couple of captains, Freddie LaFemina, Bob Morris, Terry Hatton. They all got in trouble for stuff because, you know, it was a way to get stuff into the job and official innovations and technology and development. They were always cut out most of the time. You know, because this sales, we had a guy come from Japan with a special blade for the saw called Mr. Now. He didn't speak any English, but he came and gave us a special diamond blade that would cut steel, wood, concrete, glass. Before anybody else in the country. Now it's everywhere, these combi butt blades. But we got that from Japan before it was even heard of by a guy who didn't speak English. Came to the firehouse, we fed him dinner, he gave us a whole bunch of these blades, kept coming back, bringing more blades. I think tools and innovation are a must. You got to be willing to make a little change. But don't forget where you came from.
No, it makes sense. Okay. All right. Now, when it comes to the topic of leadership, whether company officer, chief officer, obviously in your history, you have had many individuals around you that you've been able to emulate, been able to see, watch perform. So, in your opinion, what does leadership mean to you?
Leadership means to me that you're always willing to do two things. If you're a boss, you're willing to stand up for your company. And an example of that is Bob Morris. If we had a dispute with somebody at the scene of a job, that next morning he'd put his Class A's on and he'd go to headquarters to see the man, whether it was the chief operations or chief of department, and he would make his case. And he'd stand up for the company to the death, no ifs, ands, or buts. The other thing is, a company officer has to be proficient in everything he expects his members to do. You know, you can't not be able to run to the third floor if you expect your guys to run to the third floor. You can't be expected to, you know, have your guys fully dressed, flaps down, hood up, if you go to every job, you know, with your coat open. And I think those are the important things if you're a company officer. Now, for the senior man, remember, a firefighter in the back step, his first day can emulate you within weeks. So if you're doing everything the right way all the time, that's all he's going to do. But if he sees you at the gas leak, you know, your coat open or your hood not on or your flaps not down, the next gas leak, guess what he's doing?
Same thing.
Doing the same thing you did. And that's what leadership's all about, is just, showing the troops the way it is and doing the right thing.
Now, has there ever been a time that there was a beef between companies once the rescue arrives? Because, like, the reason why I ask is you mentioned the canned position. He is allowed to go and check to make sure that first line is in operation. And so I'm not saying like he's in charge, but that's a lot of responsibility. And I'm sure you had members within other companies that were like, what is this person's deal? But is it known throughout the FDNY, like, this is what the rescue does? There's no need to ask
An
what they're
AUC,
doing.
there's an AUC that says how we operate, but I'll say it like every other rescue senior guy before me. I'm not here to be liked. I'm not here to be loved. I'm here to do my job, and I'm going to do whatever the man. And like I said, the rescue company doesn't go to, even when we pull up on a working fire, we do not go to work until the chief tells us to go to work. We stand in front. So we pull up and we report into the chief, and the rescue officer always says, "Chief, what can the rescue company do for you? We're here." Sometimes the chief will put his arm out and say, "Stand fast for a minute. I think they got it." Or other times he'll say, "Rescue, go do the rescue shit. Go do what you do." Some companies, and like you said, a true rescue fireman would never ever speak bad about a company. I would never tell a story about a company leaving a line. It would never come out. It's kept secret. You never ever see that. But on the same token, does it happen? Yeah, I'm not going to deny it. But again, I don't blame, and I don't blame these junior guys in the fire service. Those problems are I blame on the company officer. Because like you said, if the company officer's not being coached, not playing coach and helping these young kids out, not talking to them, not pushing the line, not telling them it's okay, not telling them this is the way, it's maybe a second fire. And all of a sudden he's hot and his ears are burning. But no, if nobody's telling him, it's okay, just keep opening the line, it'll be better in a minute. What's he going to do? He's going to panic and leave. So I mean, there's a lot of times there's a rift between the rescue company and companies. But again, I'm not there to be liked. That's not my job. And I took it seriously. My job was when the man in the white helmet out front said, "Rescue, go in here and do your thing." AUC 203 or 275, whichever one it is, it tells where everybody in the rescue company goes and what they do. And like I said, our can man, if things got out of control, he wouldn't call the chief and say it's out of control. He'd call the rescue boss and say, "Hey, boss, the fire's out the door a little bit. Let the," or he'd call the hooker, the irons on the floor above, and say, "The fire's out the door a little bit. Get in a spot." We and you'd never ever on the radio say, "Rescue can to rescue. I'm on the line by myself. Come help." You just say, "Hey, boss, I'm on the fire floor. Can you come down here? Or I could use a hand." Was the code word, but
Gotcha.
you never ever put bad words for a company. That's not the way things go. And like you said, if something bad happened to the company, sometimes a guy got burned, whatever, and they had to back out. That's what happens too. But being there, and they said you're an extra hands on the line, and you're a coach. Hey, this is looking good, guys. You're knocking the hell out of it. And another thing you should always do. There's two things that the rescue company always did. If you were at the engine, and they did a bang up job. You didn't go talk to the boss after the job. You went over to the fireman and told the nozzle man, "My God, that was freaking spectacular what you did." So that's one thing. The second thing is the only time we got stuck, not stuck, we had to help pick up line is if we called for the line. Like if we were on the second floor and the fire was extended and you called for the line, you stay and pack the hose. Now, this didn't always get to happen because, as you know, there's only five company rescue companies. So a lot of times, the rescue chauffeur carried two radios most of the time. He carried a dispatcher radio and a fire ground radio. And the dispatcher would, "Manhattan to Rescue One, are you available? I got something coming in." Or they'd call the chief and say, "Chief, is the rescue available?" And then the chief got a radio and say, "Hey, rescue, they got another run for you." And you felt like an ass because now you had to leave, but that's just the way it was.
It
There was
is
only
what
five
it
of
is.
them.
Right. It is what, yeah. Okay. And throughout your career, how many of those did you, hey, we got to go, we got another one? And were you just like, I'm sure the when it's new, the excitement, you're like, oh, this is awesome. But I'm sure there are days where you're like, fuck.
It was towards the end of my career, I noticed that a lot more. I really did. I noticed You know, when the rescue, they'd call the chief would call and say, "Hey, rescue! They got, you know, they got a man under after you're at a job finishing up at a fire. Got a man under in the subway for you uptown." You're like, "Son of a bitch! Why the, couldn't this person have waited another hour till I washed my face?"
Right.
You know, when I got towards the end of my career, I was having a little medical problems too, and it was made it a little bit harder that way. But you know, you always tried to be available because you knew there was only five of you. And the other thing is, if you weren't available, guess what? They were sending a rescue from another borough to your borough.
Yeah, and that's, I'm sure, was like, hell no.
And the worst, the best for that was rescue too. You know,
okay.
If you got to a box downtown Brooklyn, you know, you mark up on, as when you leave Manhattan, you'd mark up on the Brooklyn frequency. When they heard that, it was like rabbit ears. They could have been at a third alarm still fighting the fire, but rescue two was available for the other box. Yeah, and it was a proud thing. You know, it was a pride thing.
Right, right. No, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No. Yeah, hey, God bless. And they said it makes you step up a little faster, makes you get back on the rig a little quicker. You know, it's sort of like, here's another one. How many guys tell you you shouldn't run at a fire?
You hear that quite often.
Let me tell you what. As long as you know your job and you can pay attention and look at the building and pick things up quickly, there's nothing wrong with stepping up to the job. What I don't like seeing, and it's the opposite, these idiots that look like they're lackadaisical, you know, guys struggling to stretch a line out and the other guys are walking up. I'm sorry, this is the person that called us. It's their worst day in their life ever. By far, they've never seen anything like this. And like you said, you're going to lackadaisical walk around? No, you bet. I'm not saying you got to all out run.
Right.
You should have a hop step going to the job, hop step doing everything.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Fair enough. Okay. Let's see here. lost my train of thought here. Okay. Which characteristic holds more weight in your opinion? Years of service, education, work ethic, or on the job experience?
I think it's two of those, but one, it comes work experience by far, because if you've done it, at least you've done it. And then ethic is by far. If you don't hold your head high every day thinking this is the greatest thing in the world, and I'm in, you know, it's like that ethnocentricity thing where you got to think your company is the best company in the world, because if you don't believe it, go somewhere else. Just, you know, I didn't dislike Alexandria. I would have stayed there and probably, I might have made captain. I know I would never have made battalion chief, you know, because they do the, at that point, they do assessment center thing, you know, more about report writing. And I was terrible. You know, I got out of high school. If I hadn't figured out about girls like in grammar school or early in high school, I probably could have been a doctor or something, but I found out about girls. So all that learning stuff went out the window. But, you know, I would have stayed in Alexandria and been proud of it. It was never a place I was dissatisfied with. I mean, did they do some stupid things? Yeah. You know, the transfer every 2 years. Oh, you got to know your company. Let's learn something else about the city. No, I learned. I was doing good. The whole company was meshed. And then they split it up. That's stupid stuff. But that work ethic, no offense or buts. If you don't think you're in the greatest company in the job, especially in New York, all you have to do is put a paper in. You know, every company is available if they have an opening. If they don't have an opening, you may have to pull a hook, you know somebody, do something good. Mm-hmm. We have to step up. You know, like for young lieutenants to get back into SOC, a lot of times they got to go back and they got to work day work at the rescue school or run the scuba unit or run the decon unit. They got to do something like that for 6 months or a year. But that gives them their privilege back into the command.
Okay.
But work ethic.
That work, yeah, work ethic. No, I wholeheartedly believe, I like to say it as, you know, your last name, and that's all you have is your last name, speaks volumes. So if somebody brings up your last name, what are they going to say about you when it comes to your work ethic? That's how I look at it.
You ever seen the video clip of Bob Morris when we were doing one of the videos where he said it takes a lifetime to make a reputation and two
mm-hmm.
minutes?
Mm-hmm.
No offense or buts. Like you said, and they said, if you screw up, the easiest way around is if you screw up is to acknowledge, look, hey,
right,
I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, I was supposed to be on the floor above and I wasn't. And, you know, and what helps with that is when the guys call you on it, you know, when the company calls you on it, you know, hey, boss, we really didn't do very well there. You know, that's the senior man's responsibility.
Right. Okay. Is it your opinion if you are assigned to a rescue company, wherever it is, it doesn't matter where in the United States, if you're assigned to a rescue company, shouldn't that individual be jam up in most proficiencies?
No, there's no if and or but, only because of the amount of things the rescue companies are expected to do.
Okay.
We said there's 5, 6, 10 aspects of non-firefighting stuff you're expected to do. That's why I believe it's really important that you're jam up a little bit senior, so you've at least been on the job a little bit, had a little work experience, went to a few fires. But the rescue companies, the other thing is, you know, and for the chiefs of the department and battalion chiefs and deputies, you have to look at it as the first three companies coming in, the engines and the trucks could have all junior guys. They could have guys that were promoted to lieutenant yesterday. But I need one company that I know when they show up, all these guys have been to fires and all these guys are step up. You know, and it's a shame to say because some places, you know, put a guy 1 year on the job on a rescue. Oh, he'll learn the job. No, this isn't the place. And like I said, I think it's the chief's fault because you're standing out front and it's going to hell in a handbasket. And who do you call on them? You know, like somebody used to say, who do we call if we can't do it? The paving company to come pave the parking lot when it's over? But I think if they would live a little bit more by, and like I said, they're afraid to say it sometimes. Look, I'm going to put all go-getter stand-up guys in this company. If you want to be in that company, that's how you get there. You know, in New York, things have changed a little bit. There's a whole like process now to get to a rescue company, but for the most part, it's still the captain's decision.
Okay.
I mean, there's like a paperwork thing now and a special transfer thing, and you got to have an interview with a rescue chief. And I mean, I had to go kiss Ray Downey's ring to go because I didn't have 5 years. You know, so I had to go to his office and actually, you know, my class A's and see him and talk to him. But they said, I think if the chief officer would just step up and say, look, we got to have one company that we know no matter what day of the week it is, it's not junior guys, it's not a junior officer, it's all senior people. And I think that would help because at the same token, the rescue company doesn't have to go on medical locals, you know, nonsense runs. So for that senior guy, it is a little bit of relief, right? Because you don't have to do the nonsense runs. You know, some engines in New York City are doing 6 or 7,000 runs a year.
Right.
You know, my nephew's in one of the busiest engines there is, 75 engine in South Bronx. Like I said, it's, you know, 6,000 runs a year. You know, how long can you do that for?
Right. Right. Okay. Looking, I always like to ask the guests where would they like to see themselves before they decide to hang it up, but you've already done that. So I'm going to kind of rephrase the question and I'm going to ask you, looking back at your career, I'm assuming that making that move was the best decision you ever made.
Besides marrying my wife and moving to the Caribbean, yeah, by far, no ifs, ands, or buts. It was like I said, we had some tough days. I had some tough days in the rescue company. You know, September 11th hurt me to my soul, still does to this day. No ifs, ands, or buts. I lost, you know, we lost half of the company, 11 guys out of 21. You know, but it was the most amazing thing ever. And like you said, if September 11th didn't happen, I've probably even been more berserk because all these senior guys would have still been there and I wouldn't have had to do as much. You know, rebuilding the company was hard because it would, you know, now you were drilling 6 or 8 times a day because you had in the back step, you had 3 out of 4 new guys in the back. So it made it very, very hard. Very, very hard. But yeah, not doing by far. And the reason I hung it up was I was physically having a hard time keeping up on the job. My lungs were bad on the 11th. And it got to the point where I was having trouble sometimes. You know, I get to the fire floor, make a push for a few minutes, and have to go to the floor below and die. You know, and I realized it was my time. You know, some guys don't ever face that fact, but I realized it was my time. I couldn't keep up anymore, and I didn't think it was right.
No, and that right there, the fact that you know it you knew it and you acknowledged it. And to me, there's no shame in that. Like at some point, everyone's different. And at some point in your career, and it doesn't have to be FDNY, it could be anywhere. When you get to a certain point where you got to listen to your body and you're like, all right, because if you don't, then you in a sense become a liability for everyone else.
No ifs or buts. And I knew that, we were the last resort for the New York City Fire Department. There was nobody else above us coming. And like you said, you had to be top of your game. If you didn't know your job and be top of the game, there was no sense in being there. And I was just at the point where I could do the game, but I wasn't the top of the game. Some guys in the rescue would transfer back to a slow truck somewhere or an engine. They would do that. Like guys would go out to the far end of Queens, close to home if they live in Long Island, or up in the North Bronx if they, lived upstate. So they'd have a shorter commute, a lot less runs. It just wasn't for me. It was time. I knew it.
Okay. And with that, you're enjoying life. You mentioned the Caribbean. Where exactly? Only if you want to say.
No. I live in Bonaire, little island of the ABC Islands next to Aruba and Curaçao. Tiny little island, no stupid rules, very peaceful. Not a lot of petty crime, if anything. Yeah, just a peaceful place. Every day 78 to 88, never changes. None of that white stuff, except for we have sea salt here. So they make sea salt. So we have a lot of white salt, but none of that snow stuff. It makes my breathing a lot easier. Cold was one of my big triggers. So here I'm like it's a godsend. And they can't keep me if I don't want to stay. That's the best part.
And when you do travel to the States, how long does it take you?
No, there's direct flights out of here. So, I mean, we're in
Okay.
Miami 2.5 hours. I'll be in. And where are you from again?
I'm in North Carolina.
No, where in North Carolina?
Just 30 minutes outside of Charlotte.
But you live, you work at,
I work in Mooresville.
and guess where I'll be on Sunday?
You'll be in Greensboro.
The following Sunday, I'll be at Epic Steakhouse.
Ah, small world, small world.
We have a big seminar going on in Greensboro next week,
Yes,
training day.
I'll be there.
Oh, I'll be there too.
Yeah, so I'll see you.
All right. Yeah. Well, so my actually one of the guys who got me interested in the fire service when I was a young volunteer, my cousin, he was an Air Force firefighter and then became a Bridgeport rescue guy, Bridgeport, Connecticut, really another ghetto. He lives in Mooresville and he retired there. So
Okay.
he was the guy that truly, being a volunteer, I would have probably been a plumber or a carpenter or something in New York and just stayed there, never been a career fireman. But I saw that he was a career fireman. He was like on top of his game. And I was like, this is the next step. So then when I got out of the military, I took tests everywhere and that was it. But he lives there and they said, we'll visit him on the following Sunday, I think.
Okay. All right. And no, that is an awesome restaurant. Very good, everything. I don't think they have anything bad there. So, but it's crazy. Small world, small world.
World. And
But
we're through there 2 or 3 times because I hunt in West Virginia in November.
okay.
So we go through Charlotte because it's the easiest place for us to get to quick.
Right.
So we'll go through Charlotte and it just makes it easy. And then we have some friends that live just south of Charlotte in South Carolina, North Carolina border.
Okay.
So we visit with them and then we hang out in Charlotte, do some shopping, because on the island there's not a lot of stores.
Right, and then you head home.
Wife can't find any clothes here that, except for a bathing suit or a muumuu.
Okay.
But we have to travel there. But we're there a couple times a year.
Okay.
My sister retired North Carolina, but out on the coast.
Okay. All right. With that being said, Joel, I really appreciate you coming on. I love hearing just the nostalgia, the stories. I mean, to me, FDNY is one of the, and I may be biased, but it's one of the greatest departments in the world. There's not very many other FDNYs out there, but I just want to say truly thank you for coming on and spreading the good word about the fire service.
Amen, brother. I agree with you. Just remember, there's 10-15% everywhere, though.
Absolutely.
Guys, face that up early. It would help out a lot. FDNY has a lot. Same thing, just like everybody else. We still put our bunker pants on one shoe at a time. The difference was at Rescue One, I didn't take them off until I went to bed.
If you got to
You know
bed.
why? Because I got sick of bending over. All right. Well, thank you. We'll see
Yes,
you in a couple.
sir. Yes,
Our
sir.
next.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll see you in like a couple days.
Yeah, we leave tomorrow. Yay.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, either way, we'll talk soon.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.